Welcome to episode 123 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and today T. Jefferson Parker joins us to talk about The Room of White Fire, his latest crime fiction novel that was published on August 22nd, 2017. In the podcast before this one, I mentioned that in addition to favorite authors, fans of crime fiction often also have favorite locations. For me, Jeff Parker is a twofer. I've been reading his novels for decades now, and one of the things that continued to pique my interest in his work, beyond enjoying his wordsmithing, noir sensibilities, and plotting, are the Southern California locations. Here's T. Jefferson Parker talking about The Room of White Fire. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I am really excited to have T. Jefferson Parker on the show today to talk about his new book, which is, today is its pub day, The Room of White Fire. Welcome, Jeff.
Well, nice to be here, Nancy.
You know, as a representative of your many legion of fans, I want to thank you for writing this. And as you said before we started recording, it's been a while. But actually, not really, just like 18 months since your last
book.
Yeah, that's
right. Mm-hmm.
It just seems longer.
It does. I don't know why. Maybe, I don't know.
A lot of things struck me about The Room of White Fire, but the first thing I'd like to ask you about is your protagonist, Roland Ford. While he's a unique character unto himself, he's a Marine, a boxer, and a dancer, I see DNA of Sean Osbourne, and who was a cohort of Charlie Hood's, and Charlie himself, and Patrick Norris from Full Measure. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, now that's interesting. I hadn't cobbled those characters together and see what if they add up to Roland a little bit, but there are certainly parallels. I think so. I think you know, when I sat down to write Roland Ford, I knew I wanted to write a PI and perhaps write a series. But I spent a lot of time just kind of thinking about, I mean, not only just his name, but the larger ramifications of his character, you know, and how you put together a modern day hero, if you will. You know, what still counts? You know, how are you a man or a woman in this society? So, I think there are elements of other heroes that I've written in him, and maybe that's why he seems kind of familiar in a way.
Well, it's interesting that's how you described Roland, that you were creating a hero. And of course, Roland is a name with a lot of hero associations. You're very good at that. You're very good at slipping in the allusions to mythology and, in this case, the Chronicles and Troubadours, and also Roland definitely was a romantic hero of the past.
Yes, that's right.
But one of the things I think all of your protagonists share, at least in your procedurals, is loss. Charlie lost the love of his life in the first of the Charlie Hood series, and Mercy Rayburn lost Tim Hess, and in The Fallen, Robbie Brownlaw actually gains something from his loss, which is synesthesia. And Silent Joe, of course, has lost his looks. Before the story in Room of White Fire begins, Roland has lost his wife in an aviation accident. And I was wondering, is loss necessary for you to build a character? And, secondary question, is his loss one of the reasons Roland is so good at finding people?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. I think loss is important. I mean, it just shapes all of us. And you know, I've had mine, and you've had yours, and my readers will have had theirs. And I think a character without loss isn't really a very believable character if he or she has any years on him at all. So in inventing Roland's early widowhood, I was able to call on my own, and I used that, and I hearken back to those days and think about them all the time, as Roland will, and we all will, our various losses, you know, and so to me it's bona fide and it's good. And the secret is, or the trick is, you don't dwell on them. You have to find a way to getting past them, and that's what Roland's all about. He's not only about getting past his own history and his own losses, but he's about helping Clay, the guy who runs away from the mental institution early in the book. He's about Clay putting himself back together after loss too. So loss is universal, and I feel it, and I think my readers will too. So you got to, if you're cobbling together a hero, he's got to have something that he's lost.
And that might be one of his motivations for being really good at finding people, because that's something you establish in the first few pages because this book is in first person, which I also found interesting. But Roland just says very flatly, I'm good at finding people. And mm-hmm. And to me, when I went further into the book, it seemed to be one of the reasons he might be good at finding people is because he's always looking, which, as you mentioned, when you've lost something or somebody, especially when you've lost somebody, you are looking. First, you're looking for that person, and then you're looking. Yeah. Then you're looking for something else.
Well said. Well said. I think there was in an earlier draft of the book, I wrote a line in there fairly early on. It had something to do with Roland says something like, you know, one of the reasons I'm good at finding people is because I know it takes a lot, and the one person that I'm really looking for the most, I'll never find. You know, so he feels that loss, and he knows what it means to go out and look for that and for something beyond that. But I cut that line out because I thought it was too on the nose. So I left it out. I left it something to the effect that, you know, I'm good at finding people. And so that's close reading on your part. That's a good observation.
Well, thanks. When we talked about your previous novel, Crazy Blood, which was about skiing, I actually said that no one does crazy like you. But I think what I should have said was unhinged evil. And Room of White Fire takes a serious tone towards mental illness and the situations that can trigger it, like war. There's nothing evil about Clay Hickman, who's a veteran of the war in Iraq that Ford has been asked to locate. But some of the characters in the book suffer from mental disorders, but others are just evil. And so there's a difference, isn't there?
Yeah, I think so. You know, what I was trying to get with Clay is he's a good guy, and he's born into a well-to-do, very well-to-do family. He struggled in childhood with bad health, and yet he overcomes his small stature and his early childhood ailments, and he cobbles together a strong young man who though still kind of smallish, you know, rise as a scholar and an athlete in high school, and then joins the Air Force to serve his country, and he wants to be a hero, and he's a good guy. And so this story then is about that great, great hidden cost, huge and often secret, that I think that everybody who serves and goes into combat pays. And that's what Clay is paying.
But you frequently have evil in your book, either personified as a character like Mike Finnegan, or as a sort of a miasma, which I thought Room of White Fire had both, sort of that just evil sort of atmosphere that grew from the secrets that were kept for some really bad things that happened in the war, as well as Briggs, who's about as evil as they come, I think.
He does some reprehensible things, you know, both during the war and after, and yet he very nimbly and happily turns a huge profit on all of them. And so that starts to creep up to the definition of evil for me. I'm not sure that I write evil very, very well or very wholly, but if there is an evil in the book, it would be Briggs and what he's trying to get away with, and the massive, almost monstrous rationalization that he is able to bring to his own affairs and his own doings. That to me approaches, if not evil, at least, psychopathy.
On a lighter note, Roland lives in a compound. I'm so sorry. Roland lives in a compound of sorts in Fallbrook, which is an area you know quite well. And I appreciate the characters that share his compound with him, including his divorced grandparents. And Roland refers to them as the Irregulars, which is, I guess, a nod to Sherlock Holmes. And I was wondering, is this fun to create? And do you have a favor of this motley crew?
That's funny that you would ask that, Nancy. Cause, he calls them the Irregulars. He rents out these casitas on his estate, which is bequeathed to him by his past wife and her fabulously wealthy family. It was their wedding present. So now he's sort of stuck with this giant compound out in the hills, and he's got six casitas that line this pond, and he rents them out to people, for money, of course, why not? But also because he's kind of lonely. So he collects these people and he handpicks them, and they're kind of an odd crew. So he calls them the Irregulars. And I wrote the Irregulars as just kind of standard, everyday comic relief for a book that's really pretty dark and pretty intense, like you were saying. And I thought, well, it would make sense that it's a nice sort of nod to Roland's sociability and his loneliness, perhaps, that he kind of collects these odd people just to have someone to talk to, you know. And I started giving early copies of the book out, you know, an editor read it up, you know, quickly, agent, of course, and then, you know, early drafts to, you know, various friends and people. And to a person, they came back to me and said, you know what I like, one of the things I like most about this book, I like the Irregulars. They just love the Irregulars. And you mentioned the Irregulars now without me even bringing it up. So, yeah, the Irregulars are there. I'm totally having fun with them. And, you know, the grouchy old grandparents are fun. And the little guy, Bert Short, is not only fun and interesting, but, you know, integral to the Room of White Fire. And as I'm working on the second book in the series, revolves around Lindsay Rakes, who is the drone pilot who leaves Roland at the end, leaves the compound at the end of this book to return to her family in Las Vegas. So I'm getting a lot of mileage and a lot of fun out of the Irregulars so far.
Well, this is, like you said, it is a little bit of comic relief in a book that is the premise of which is very, very dark. And I don't want to introduce any spoilers, but the wars that this country has fought over the last 16 years really hang like just this heavy blanket of misfortune and unhappiness. And I think it falls mostly on young men and women. A whole generation seems to be getting damaged by this. And I think that's one of the things that this book is about, this sort of hidden damage. You know, it's not obvious to well, it's, you live in the vicinity of Pendleton, but for most of us, it's not obvious. It's, you know, they just go do their job and everybody's thankful and thanks them for their service and buys them a drink. But the damage that it's causing is, I think, will be felt long after my lifetime and probably yours.
Well, me too. I totally agree. Well said, by the way. But I totally agree. And the way I like to say it in agreement is I truly do believe that that our wars of the past 16 years are the defining story in American life. And those definitions and those repercussions will continue on for generations. You know, if I had to boil the whole thing down in the Room of White Fire and perhaps other books that I will write in the future, I really do think that there is a hidden cost to these wars, and the hidden cost is most dramatically and visually visible in the people who fight them. And I see him every day coming in and out of Pendleton. And that story is very important. And if I, as a writer, can entertain my readers, first and foremost, and maybe shed some sort of sympathetic light or fictional illumination to what that cost is, person to person, then I'm writing something that's worth reading.
Well, you know, you're singing to the choir, but... I mean, I have seen, in the past 16 years, I have seen
this change. You stepped away from procedurals to write a book specifically about veterans. In the book before Room of White Fire, which the name of which is just escaping me, and
Full Measure. After that was Crazy Blood, and they're related because they both have as a protagonist a veteran. Yeah.
And when you said that it's sort of hidden, I think, especially with books like yours, it is less and less hidden and more apparent. And the idea of a survivor, and you know, sort of with air quotes, someone might be physically look like a survivor, and the scars are deep and real, which is what ends which is how Clay ends up in Arcadia.
Yep.
And that's the next thing I want to ask you about. Once again, here we go. The mental health facility is called Arcadia, which in myth is the home of Pan, you know, the guard of partying. And it's supposed to be a pastoral region of innocence and contentment. I looked that up on the Google. But your Arcadia is a little, it has like a sinister side, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. For the listeners, the readers, Arcadia is the name of a high-end, very expensive, exclusive mental institution hidden in the mountains of San Diego up by Palomar Observatory. And it's like none other in the world. It's wholly an invention of mine. There is no Arcadia up there because there's nothing in the world quite like Arcadia. But what Arcadia is in the book, it's a mental institution for very rich and privileged people. And it is a place where Clay Hickman goes to try to recover from his moral injury in the war. And it's a bright and hygienic and geometrically constructed place of concrete and mirrors and windows, and it's kind of cantilevered up over the back of this mountain, and it's very architecturally kind of perilous, and it's full of trained professional doctors and nurses everywhere you look, and they don't have patients, they call them partners, and they all live there in this kind of idyllic place, and yet Roland, you know, a PI that he is, and man that he is, he walks in, and after, you know, just a very few, you know, hours spent in Arcadia talking to Clay Hickman's doctors and security guys, he begins to suspect that Arcadia is not at all this idyllic place of the pastoral place or any kind of a mental hospital where people are getting truly the best care that there is. That things don't seem right to him.
So it's your touch of noir. These sort of throughout your books you've had these hidden in plain sight facilities, not unlike Arcadia, and I find that very, very noir. That there's more than meets the eye in this sort of shiny, sunny SoCal, just like you described Arcadia as being full of windows and light and seemingly sanitized and hygienic,
yeah,
and yet deeply, deeply disturbing on many levels.
Yeah, it certainly proved to be. Yeah.
So in one of the press releases I read, they said that Room of White Fire is the first of a series. So I'm excited about that. You mentioned that you are working on a second book and that the Irregulars will be back, which of course makes me happy. And so I'm wondering about Dr. Paige Hewlett, who is one of the doctors at Arcadia that Roland meets and may or may not be a romantic interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Paige Hewlett is a smart, lovely woman who is Clay's doctor, and she's the head psychiatrist at Arcadia, and she's the first woman that Roland has found himself or given permission to himself to be attracted to since the death of his wife a year and a half ago. So he, Roland's, you know, relationship, if you will, with Paige Hewlett is crammed with the ghosts of his past, not to mention hers, which we learn later in the book, They have a really interesting thing going in the Room of Whitefire, and I don't know if we're going to see her again or not, Nancy. I'm not positive about that.
Well, it does make it a little bit more interesting to have him be a free agent, as it were, you know, going through these adventures. And certainly Charlie managed to get from point A to point B. I'm mentioning Charlie Hood from your previous six-book series, you know, without a permanent romantic partner. So I guess it's possible, but the Irregulars, you already mentioned that the Irregulars will be back.
Yeah, got to have them. And his compound where he lives, Roland's compound, is the big house where he lives, and the six casitas and the pond and the big driveway and the dirt roads that go out, you know, through the hillsides and stuff. It's kind of taken on a character's position. You know, I spent a lot of time there in the Room of Whitefire, and there's going to be a lot of scenes set there. In the next book, the book I'm working on now, so that compound's going to come back, and Roland will be another year older and another year wiser. Hopefully, it's going to be really interesting to write him over the years. You know, I did so much of the Charlie Hood series thoughtlessly. I didn't put any thought at all, really, into the next Charlie Hood book when I was working on one. I just didn't operate that way. And when I look back on those six books, they seem like one book to me. And the Roland books are going to play out a little differently. I think what's going to happen is each book is going to be a little more discreet and a little more of a little bit more of a standalone, you could say, within the series, rather than kind of a book that's going to be, you know, tightly harnessed to the six books down the road. I don't think the Roland series is going to read as one book. I'm going to try to make it read as however many books, each one being individually discreet and satisfying and autonomous.
Well, when we talked once about the Charlie Hood series, I think you told me that you always envisioned it as six books long. So do you have a discrete number of books in mind for Roland Ford now, or is it going to be a case-by-case basis?
It's going to be case-by-case. I don't have a number, you know, don't have a number. A lot of it depends on how the books do, if people like them, and a lot of it depends on my emotional creative, you know, bank account, you know, how much remains in it for Roland and the series. And right now my bank account is stuffed. I feel really, really loaded with ideas for him, and I'm not good at all about thinking about stories or books into the future, but I do feel I really like the character of Roland, and I like the setting. I like the world that he's a part of. I like the fact that he's a PI, and technically he can be hired to do anything anywhere in the world, really. So he can go, you know, and he can stay. And I like his, you know, relative youth, and he has a lot of life to live, but he's got just enough behind him to be interesting. So I feel like I'm in a good place to stay with this character for a while.
Well, from your mouth to God's ear, I never thought I'd meet anybody I liked as much as Charlie, but Roland is definitely, I grew on me immediately, and I found myself really, really liking him and wanting to hear more about him. And, you know, it might be, you know, I sometimes people say that I have a Southern California-centric taste, and that's true. I do, you know, because I can see the places that you're writing about, and, you know, that makes a connection. But it's also, I think, and, you know, we've talked about this before, capturing this idea that Southern California, you know, for all people think it's, you know, very simple and beach and surf and all that, that it's really, there are sinister elements, and there always have been, and you do a good job of sort of peeling back the layers and letting the readers see that kind of noir side of our state without, you know, without scaring everybody away.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That, you know, that puts me smack dab in the middle of a long, long tradition, noir tradition, you know, that has always, you know, that has flourished so well in Southern California. So it's nice to be a part of that battalion of noirists out there. And I'm drawn to that simple idea that as you just said, you know, right beneath the sun is the shadow, and the shadows kind of define the sun and illuminate the sun as much as the other way around.
Thanks again for talking to us about Room of White Fire, and we look forward to the next, or at least I do, and, you know, that's really all that counts. I look forward to the next Roland Ford. Do you have a name for it yet, or is it still as yet unnamed?
Yes, it has a title after many months of negotiation, and the title is Swift Vengeance.
Very good. Thank you, Jeff Parker, T. Jefferson Parker, for joining us and talking about The Room of White Fire.
Thank you, Nancy. It's good to talk.